Monday, August 17th. This is VOA's International Edition. I'm Lori London in Washington. Coming up, despite recent violent crackdowns, a massive number of people took to the streets again over the weekend in Belarus to protest an election they say was rigged.
Probably the largest rally in the history of Belarus following the collapse of the Soviet Union. Estimates run from 100,000 to 500,000.
Concerns over the threat of another lockdown in countries in Europe where coronavirus cases are spiking again.
And a lot of the new infections are younger people, people aged between 15 and 40 years old. So that is a real concern.
Also ahead, reaction around the world to Beyoncé's new 85-minute new film, Black is King. It's all on today's International Edition. Presumptive Democratic presidential nominee Joe Biden looks to make it official this week when he formally accepts his party's nomination at the Democratic National Convention starting tonight. Biden made history last week by naming California Senator Kamala Harris as his running mate. The first Black woman and the first person of Indian descent on a presidential ticket this week also becomes part of a history-making, mostly virtual convention. VOA's Arash Arabasadi has more.
Former Vice President Joe Biden and Senator Kamala Harris made their first joint appearance in Wilmington, Delaware last week. This after the historic decision to name her as his running mate in the Democrats' effort to defeat Republican President Donald Trump in the November election. This election cycle, the Democratic National Convention, or DNC, selected Milwaukee, Wisconsin as the host city. But concerns of COVID-19 moved most of the official nominating ceremony online. It will still feature party heavyweights, past and present, from former Democratic presidential nominee Hillary Clinton and former President Barack Obama to Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, the first-term representative from New York. Former presidential candidate and current Senator Bernie Sanders says Harris bolsters the party's ticket.
I believe that Kamala is, as somebody who has known her for a number of years, incredibly smart, incredibly tough. And I would not like to be Vice President Pence in a debate with her. I think she's an asset for the Biden campaign. And I think she's going to do great on the campaign trail.
I heard it today that she doesn't meet the requirements. And by the way, the lawyer that wrote that piece is a very highly qualified, very talented lawyer.
President Trump at a recent news conference in Washington said he heard compelling arguments questioning Harris's eligibility to run in response to a question from VOA. Harris was born in Oakland, California, and critics compared Trump's remarks to his previous false allegations questioning former President Obama's U.S. citizenship.
I'm signing this because I am in this race to win.
Senior Trump campaign advisor Jason Miller blames the news media for focusing on the issue regarding Harris's eligibility.
This is something the media keeps bringing up, whether to him in his press conferences or even in interview formats like this where it's being brought up. It is not something that anyone in our campaign is talking about. The president said that he doesn't, it's not something they're pursuing, not something that we're interested in. And in our opinion, it is case closed, end of story, and the only folks who keep bringing it up are the media.
The one thing that remains undisputed is the upcoming Democratic National Convention, where Biden is expected to receive and accept the party's nomination for the presidency. The DNC runs from August 17th to the 20th. Trump will accept his party's nomination at the Republican National Convention that begins on the 24th. Arash Arabasadi, VOA News, Washington.
Countries in Europe have been touted with their swift and serious efforts to get the coronavirus pandemic under control early on, even in hard-hit countries. But with a new spike in cases in a number of places, there are growing fears of another lockdown and the economic pain that would ensue. Joining us now for details is Paris-based reporter Catherine Field. Catherine, let's start with where you are in France. What's the situation there?
Here in France, we've had a second day of 3,000 plus new infections. Those are the highest numbers since May. It's led to two major cities here in Paris and Marseille widening the public zones where face masks are compulsory. We're also going to see in the next few days the government holding talks with members of the employers union to find some way that the government can impose face masks in indoor shared spaces from the end of August. So there they're looking at the possibilities of making people wear face masks when they get back into the office after the summer holidays.
And Catherine, I know this isn't just limited to France. Sounds like Italy and Spain and other countries are starting to grow concerned with the number of cases rising per day.
Indeed, the infection rates are really climbing up. We're looking at Italy has closed nightclubs and discotheques. So has Spain. Just on Sunday, Italy brought in a law making face masks mandatory in public from 6 p.m. at night to 6 a.m. There they had more than 600 new cases on Sunday. So again, we're looking at widespread number of new cases, and that is the real concern.
And there's also concerns, I imagine, of fresh lockdowns with worries that these numbers could continue to rise in the next couple weeks.
One of the big problems that Europe is dealing with at the moment and for the next 10 days is that we're coming to the end of the summer holiday period. So you're going to have a lot of movement around the country, particularly more than usual, because Europeans haven't been able to travel as much as they would outside of their own country. So you're going to see more and more people traveling between holiday destinations back to the major cities. That is on top of the fact that we've got all these new infections, and a lot of these new infections are younger people, people aged between 15 and 40 years old. So that is a real concern. The government's going to have to find a way to track, trace, test all these young people, do that before they get back to university or go back to high school. Plus, they've got to bring in some sort of emergency information campaign to tell these young people, all right, you may not be as badly affected by this virus as some other people, but please do not go and visit granny. Don't go and visit your family. When you come back from holiday, stay home, stay in your apartments. Because what these European governments do not want is any new lockdown. It has really hurt the economies of Europe. It has hurt the morale of the population. They feel if they can introduce measures such as testing, such as face masks, that they may be saved from having another very intense lockdown period.
Paris-based reporter Catherine Field, thank you so much. In Belarus, more than 100,000 people gathered in Minsk and other cities on Sunday for a ninth straight day of demonstrations after a disputed August 9th election gave President Alexander Lukashenko another term in office. Protesters in what's being dubbed March for Freedom are calling for Lukashenko to resign in what appears to be the biggest challenge of his long-time rule. Joining us now from Moscow is reporter Charles Maines. Thanks so much for being with us. So you've been following these protests since the beginning, and despite stories of a violent police response and thousands of protesters being arrested, it doesn't seem to be stopping these people from taking to the streets. Give us an update on the latest from over the weekend.
There's sort of two sources of outrage among the protesters right now. First of all, it's the actual election from last Sunday on August 9th. This is when Belarusian strongman, longtime leader Alexander Lukashenko, said he won with 80% of the vote in though it was supposed to be the most contested election of his 26-year hold on power. He says that his nearest rival, this was a woman named Svetlana Tikhanovskaya, and she received just 10% of the vote despite drawing just enormous crowds in the run-up to the election. So that's part one. Part two is the response. Once people heard this result, which many thought was rigged, they went out onto the streets and they were met with the state police force, the interior ministry troops who arrested 7,000. Many came out of the prisons a few days later looking dazed, had welts and bruises all over their bodies. So there was real question about the police crackdown and just the response of the police, which of course the protesters lay at the feet of Lukashenko.
But it sounds like they're upset enough and angry enough that whatever the repercussions have been, it's not deterring them.
Yeah, that's right. You know, we've seen these contested elections in Belarus before. As I said, Lukashenko's been in power for 26 years, and he's had several of these elections where the same issues come up: election fraud, pressure against his opposition candidates, some are banned from participating in the race. This time seemed different because people seemed so outraged by the response of police. I think there was genuine shock, and the result has not been to cow the public, but in fact draw more and more out. Today we saw a huge rally, probably the largest rally in the history of Belarus following the collapse of the Soviet Union. Estimates run from 100,000 to 500,000. I won't speak to what the exact number was, but it was massive, and there was no doubt about that. These were people calling for change. They want Lukashenko out. They were also expressing just outrage over the police violence that they saw over the past few days. And we've seen also the police, frankly, step down. I mean, they step back after really coming out hard on the first 3 days after the election. I think they realized that they were losing the public, and so they stepped down a bit. And we don't see that same level of violence, but of course, it's still a concern.
Young people out there, you can certainly see that.
Yeah, I think that's an aspect here as well, definitely. Lukashenko's base is among older Belarusians, mostly in the rural parts of Belarus. He himself was a former collective farm manager. So he appeals to them in a way with offering a kind of stability, almost as if the collapse of the Soviet Union never happened. Whereas there's this dynamic sort of urban young Belarus that's on the rise here. And these people really don't see much in Lukashenko that appeals to them. And that's definitely been clear.
European Union leaders have been weighing what to do about this. They are very concerned. But I know at least one of Lukashenko's neighbors seems to be a willing ally.
That's right. Russia has come to Lukashenko's aid. In fact, they today made an announcement that they were willing, in theory, to provide military assistance to the Belarusian government, to Lukashenko, if needed. This is under a collective security agreement the two sides have. But frankly, I mean, what's interesting here is that, you know, for Russia, I think a lot of people are wondering whether this would somehow be a repeat of what we saw in Ukraine in 2014 when Russian forces went in. You have Belarus as kind of a buffer state between NATO countries and Russia. And Russia does have that interest in sort of keeping Belarus in its orbit. But I think they do recognize that certainly a lot of voices here I'm hearing from Moscow say that it's, you know, it would be a disaster if Russia went in. I mean, first of all, Russia's been pursuing a sort of a super state, a union with Belarus over the last several years. Lukashenko's always kind of dismissed it. He doesn't really want to be the younger partner to this or smaller partner to this super state with Russia. And even Belarusians themselves, even if they're not fans of Lukashenko, they don't seem to have much interest in joining up with Russia. So I think the idea of sending Russian troops in just provokes the idea of some kind of civil war with Russian troops facing losses. And I think there's also concern that they're backing a loser at this point. And I think there's a sense that Lukashenko is maybe not here for the long haul, whether he's goes in the next week or the next month or next year. I think there's a sense that he's lost his mandate among certainly the Belarusian people. But again, there are a lot of questions about how this unfolds. Lukashenko today had a rally in Minsk where he made clear he had no intention of giving up power. He said that essentially enemies within the country and outside the country, NATO countries, were planning to take over the government and ruin Belarus. But I think there's also a really important aspect to this, which is that there is no anti-Russian bent in these protests per se. This is Belarusians rising up against a longtime dictator in Alexander Lukashenko. So that offers some maneuver here that maybe wasn't apparent in, say, Ukraine.
Reporter Charles Maines in Belarus. Thanks so much. The UN Development Program warns a lot of toxic waste, potentially dangerous to health and the environment, was discharged when more than 2,700 tons of ammonium nitrate exploded at the port of Lebanon's capital, Beirut, nearly 2 weeks ago. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from Geneva.
UN officials say they do not know the magnitude of the problem and are assessing the types of debris, bricks, steel, glass, unleashed by the blast. Rekha Das is UN Development Program crisis advisor. Speaking on a video link from Beirut, she says hazardous waste, medical waste, and electronic waste also must be taken into account.
We have to find out what is dangerous and what is not dangerous, what can be recycled and what cannot be recycled. And if it cannot be recycled, then where can it be safely disposed? Lebanon already had a huge solid waste crisis before the blast. The blast has added another massive long-term dimension to this crisis.
In addition to the waste and contamination on land, Das says work is going ahead to assess the environmental impact of the blast on the Mediterranean Sea. She tells VOA the UN is collaborating with the European Union and experts on toxic and general waste to evaluate the situation. She says this mission is not easy to accomplish because of the difficulty and risks involved in accessing the sites.
There's still bricks and roofing that falls down from roofs and window panes. So we have to be careful ourselves when going in, and careful, you know, protect the engineers that we're working with, the syndicate of engineers, our EU colleagues, and everybody has to take this step by step.
Das says the magnitude of the problem is particularly great because waste management issues existed and were neglected in the country well before the explosion blew away much of what had been Lebanon's beautiful capital, Beirut, by the sea. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
U.S. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo is warning leaders in the Czech Republic, Slovenia, and Austria that China's Communist Party poses an even bigger security threat than the former Soviet Union. VOA's diplomatic correspondent Cindy Sain has more on Pompeo's trip to Eastern Europe.
On his tour of Eastern Europe, Secretary of State Mike Pompeo sought to strengthen bilateral ties on a range of issues. He acknowledged the unrest in Belarus following contested elections and the arms embargo on Iran. But the threat posed by China's Communist Party and its telecommunications infrastructure was a central thread running through each stop.
I think the whole world can plainly see now that the Chinese Communist Party is intent on using this telecommunications infrastructure for purposes that no other telecom system in the world does, right? They're using it as deeply tied to their national security apparatus, to their intelligence community, to their military forces, all the data.
China has dismissed Pompeo's warnings, saying that wherever he goes, he always spreads, quote, political viruses, quote, and false information. But the warnings about Huawei and others have already borne fruit, with Pompeo signing a joint declaration with Slovenian Foreign Minister Anže Logar that excludes untrusted vendors from 5G networks. One expert told VOA Pompeo's focus on China is having an impact.
I think the administration's leadership on this issue in particular really has helped turn the tide on the question, and I think that more and more countries are going to be falling in line on the issue of Chinese involvement in the next generation telecommunications.
Daniel Kochis told VOA he believes Russia is still a more immediate threat to Central and Eastern Europe than China.
But I think that China still remains somewhat of the longer term threat here. I think that Russia still, because of the threat of military action, because of propaganda, still is sort of the first and foremost threat to the Central European region.
Another expert agreed that Eastern European countries are facing more immediate and pressing issues than the threat from China, and urged a more balanced message.
So at the same time that, yes, China is an important element of our foreign policy, and it cannot be the only focus. We have to have a more nimble, more multi-vectored approach to these countries.
Pompeo also consulted with leaders at each stop about the dramatic events in Belarus.
Just as I talked about in the Czech Republic, we want the people of Belarus to have the freedoms that they're demanding, that they think are in their best interests. We watch the protests. We urge that the nonviolent protesters be protected and not harmed.
Austrian Foreign Minister Alexander Schallenberg told reporters the U.S. and the European Union agree that the elections were neither free nor fair. And he said he wants the EU to issue a clear call to Belarus leader Alexander Lukashenko to immediately end the violence and arbitrary detentions and release the remaining prisoners. Cindy Sain, VOA News, Washington.
Here are some of the other stories we are following at VOA. The U.S. Postal Service's internal watchdog is investigating cost-cutting that has slowed delivery and alarmed lawmakers ahead of a presidential election when up to half the U.S. voters could be casting ballots by mail. The Postal Service's Inspector General also will examine possible conflicts of interest involving new Postmaster General Louis DeJoy, who has donated $2.7 million to President Trump and his fellow Republicans. Bahrain and Oman could be the next Gulf countries to follow the United United Arab Emirates in formalizing ties with Israel, according to Israel's intelligence minister, Eli Cohen. He told Army Radio Sunday that the agreement will lead to more. Hong Kong Chief Executive Carrie Lam has resigned from an honorary fellowship at a college at Britain's Cambridge University after it questioned her commitment to the protection of human rights and freedom of expression. Lam said the accusations made by Wolfson College were, quote, groundless and a disappointing smear of a person on the basis of hearsay and not facts. You're listening to International Edition. We'll be back in a minute.
Hello, this is Heather Maxwell, host of Music Time in Africa. Join me every Saturday and Sunday for an hour of awesome African music. Like to stay on top of new music trends, breakout artists, new releases? Maybe you just love the classic styles and artists of the past. Or simply the sound and feel of a good beat. Whatever your pleasure, you can get it every week right here on Music Time in Africa. So join me on your local FM station, Saturdays and Sundays at 1500 and 2000 UTC.
VOA's International Edition continues. In Africa, while most countries have so far managed to escape some of the worst and more serious health impacts of COVID-19 than other places around the world have experienced, there is concern that the continent will face major economic disruptions due to lockdown measures and other public health policies meant to contain the virus spread. Economists say on a continent where a majority of the population depends on the SME ecosystem, it makes sense to invest in that sector to ultimately lessen the economic impact of the pandemic. A Rwandan organization known as Inkomoko Entrepreneur Development is hoping to assist by providing support to some 35,000 small business entrepreneurs. Managing Director Natali Nianzima tells VOA's Jackson Vunganyi that the funds from part of a $2.3 million grant from MasterCard Foundation will go to mainly refugee populations and surrounding communities.
In total, we supported about 12,000, and only this year we're talking about 9,000. So the first criteria is to have gone through our program, whether this year or in the past. We are looking for, I would say, most of the business, most of the refugee-owned businesses are in retail. And so the goal for the grant is to have those small businesses get back to their pre-COVID revenue and pre-COVID employment level.
SMEs that operate within the refugee camp themselves, run yes. by refugees.
Yes. Also, as part of integration or even or to improve the integration of refugees and the host communities, part of that pool will include Rwandans who live in the surrounding areas or surrounding communities of the refugee camps.
And now, why did you specifically target the refugee population and how does this affect say their relationship with their host communities?
There has been at the global level, I think, and I think at the country level as well, a change of, or a shift in strategy on how the refugees are supported in their host country. So traditionally, they used to get allowance in kind, whether it's firewood, whether it's soap, whether it's blanket, etc. And so a lot has changed, and I think the funding has been drying year after year, the funding towards supporting refugees. So this is a more sustainable way of helping them be resilient and help them probably graduate from assistance.
And what kind of businesses do refugees often run?
In most of the cases, they have corner shops or retail, so they are responding to the needs they see in where they are located, right? So you have corner shops with foodstuff, with with really the, I would say, the basic necessity, whether it's soap or a candle or anything that is really needed in a small household in a refugee camp. And agriculture. I think looking at the economy of Rwanda, agriculture is really a big sector. So they're really involved in the primary production.
What's the size of the grants given to each of these entrepreneurs? And what criteria do you use to measure or to determine the financial needs of their business operations?
So the grant amount is really based on the size of the business. We have a range of from $100 up to $8,000. So it's really wholesalers would qualify for a larger amount than someone who's selling charcoal in a market. And also this grant is coming to supplement the services that we were already providing them. As I mentioned, we are a consulting firm and we're providing business training and consulting. So prior to getting this financing in form of a grant, they have received trainings in cash flow management or bookkeeping or in sales to make sure that once they get the grant, they will really know how to put it to good use.
What kind of unique problems do refugees face during this COVID-19 pandemic?
That's interesting. That's a good question. I think it's very important before I respond to that, I think it's important to understand maybe the environment or the type of rights or no rights that they actually have. But I think in a large majority of part of countries, refugees don't necessarily have access to, they don't have access to free movement, they don't have access, they're not allowed to open business or have a bank account or even have a national ID.
Natalie Nianzima, Managing Director of Inkomoko Entrepreneur Development in Rwanda, speaking with VOA's Jackson Vunganyi. And Beyoncé's latest surprise drop, Black is King, is gaining both fans and detractors around the world for its dazzling, colorful, sumptuous portrayal of African culture. But in South Africa, where her crew filmed several scenes in the 85-minute musical feature, viewers and those who participated in the production say it's an important part of an emerging narrative. VOA's Anita Powell reports from Johannesburg.
Black is King is a new visual album and musical film directed, executive produced, and written by American singer-songwriter Beyoncé. The film stands alongside her album, The Lion King, The Gift. It was shot last year in the U.S., South and West Africa, and Europe, and features many African artists. The film, released in July, has been generally well received by audiences, but it does have its critics. Some say that Beyoncé, who was born in the U.S. city of Houston, in Texas, is guilty of cultural appropriation for using African imagery throughout the work without having any specific cultural roots to the continent. But in South Africa, those involved in the production were thrilled.
I'm really, really honored to have become part of the crew that put together this film. And on me, on my side, I really, really like the film. I really love the film. It went into a lot of things that we haven't been told in our schools about Black history. And when I saw the film, that's when I started to see that the stories and the attires and outfits that she was putting and the whole scene really represented something deeper than what people were expecting.
While the film is not widely available on the continent, South Africa's largest cable provider made it available to premium subscribers. Beyoncé fan Kosi Mutswane says African diaspora, including Black Americans, have the right to reference what some see as African culture. The founder of a project to tell queer narratives, Mutswane says he mostly loved the film.
Like, there are areas where I felt like Black skin could have been improved. For example, as a queer person, I would have loved to see more. I know she worked with a lot of queer people, but I would have liked to see that representation on camera.
Beyoncé's picture of Black culture and power comes as U.S. Democrat Senator Kamala Harris became the first Black woman vice presidential pick.
Black women have always been on the lowest sort of like strata of social hierarchy. And to have them occupy these really key, critical, profoundly influential platforms is really heartening and it's encouraging.
Student filmmaker Matibula says Beyoncé's film inspired him to work on his own project to tell more African stories. On one thing, her African supporters agree. If black is king, Beyonce is the queen. Anita Paul, VOA News, Johannesburg. If the storm
comes. You've been listening to International Edition. That's it for our show today, but you can always find us at voanews.com. On behalf of our producer, Jackson Vunganyi, I'm Lori London in Washington. Thanks so much for being with us and have a great day. To believe in.